Welcome to Stop the Machine, the first episode in a brand new podcast from Compassion in World Farming's campaign against factory farming. I'm Julie Smith, and in this episode we're on tour with Philip Limbury, who's talking about his latest book, Dead Zone, Where the Wild Things Were.
Philip, you've just arrived in Bristol at this fantastic wharf. The canal boats going past this ancient city kind of coming to life this morning. What do you want out of the day?
Well, I'm really looking forward to speaking to what I hope will be a really interested audience, looking forward to what the future holds, a more sustainable future, a better food future. That's why I'm here. You know, a week ago I was in Spain, the week before I was in New York, last night at the Natural History Museum, and here today at the Watershed in Bristol.
As CEO for Compassion in World Farming, part of Philip's job is to persuade factory farmers and their consumers to change the way they treat animals destined for the plate. But more than campaigning for a more ethical approach to animals, Philip argues in Dead Zone that ending the wasteful practice of feeding grain to animals would stop the machine that's also destroying wildlife all over the world. Facilitating the talk today is author and philosopher Julian Baggini. As we meet for a coffee before the talk, he explains why he thinks being hungry more often could be the key to stopping the machine.
The Italians would call me a buona forchetta, which I like. It's like a good fork. You know, I do like my food. Everything in our society is designed to close the gap between desire and action. That's how the consumer society works. So learning to kind of recognise you're hungry is a kind of good part of a general training in that kind of impulse control, if you like, to resist the impulsivity of consumerism.
But presumably there's a direct link between that philosophy and compassion in world farming, ethical treatment of animals, because once you've been mindful of what you put into your body or what you don't put into your body at different times, presumably you are then going to be more aware of the process of behind the food that you're putting in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of mindfulness you're after is multifaceted. It's not, I mean, part of it is simply that kind of habit of stopping and watching, but you also have to stop and think. And actually, there's lots of very nice psychology experiments which show this, you know, what we think, what we believe, how we're feeling, the sounds in the background, the colours of the place, all these things actually make a difference to how things taste and how we eat. When you become more aware about where your food comes from, it alters your appreciation and your relationship to it. I mean, yeah, when you not only know about the kind of issues that compassion campaigns about, but you also know just, you know, nice things about how something's been made in a traditional way in a nice farm or something, you know, it goes into the mouth and the tongue and it makes it different.
Well, and it comes from the meat, doesn't it, Philip? I mean, you know, you're lobbying for animals free to roam, able to exhibit their natural characteristics. That makes the meat better. I mean, I know that you don't eat meat, but that's not the point. What you're saying, Julian, is exactly the same for the farmer.
It's absolutely right. That if you treat the animals well, then you get a better quality food, better quality meat, milk and eggs, better quality nutritionally. And you know, the one thing which people tell me wherever I go in the world, whenever I speak to wonderful higher welfare farmers or the customers that buy from them, what the people consistently say is, it tastes so much better.
Actually, what you discover is when you look into food is the way everything relates to everything else. So, you know, concern for animal welfare does link with ecology and economics and nutrition, etc., etc. The kind of default Western mindset tends to be one which divides things up into, you know, specialist areas of knowledge, specialist areas of understanding. You know, even food, we break up to the micronutrients, you know, it's fat, protein, sugar and everything. And the next level is putting it all together and seeing how whole systems change the elements.
Are you feeling positive about our future?
Well, thanks to people like Philip, actually, I do feel reasonably positive. Most people I meet are extremely pessimistic, actually. But there are various things that make me positive. The first is that we do know that the problem, even at the moment, isn't a lack of food. It's how the food is distributed and stored and so forth. We also know that it's going to be unsustainable to have kind of Western levels of consumption of animal products globally, but that's not really a problem either, because, I mean, what I find is, you know, I've been concerned with these issues for a long time, and I do eat meat, but little meat and whatever. And if ever I read an article about, you know, cut down your meat consumption, etc., etc., and I look, and what they recommend, I think, my God, do people really eat that much? You know, so we're going to be, I think we're going to be able to enjoy all the things we currently enjoy, and there'll be plenty for everyone. It's just that the balance isn't going to be exactly as it is, but that will be a good thing, really. You know, I mean, we don't need big chunks of animal protein on our plates every day.
As Philip tells the audience at the Watershed in Bristol about his global investigation into the impact of cheap meat on animal extinction, he warns that the well-being of society depends on a thriving natural world where corn is used for food rather than fuel and where it doesn't cost the earth.
So thank you all very much for your attention today. Thanks for being part of the, what I believe is the revolution that we need to bring about a sane food system, one which treats the welfare of animals decently, which protects wildlife and preserves the legacy that we are leaving for our children. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you.
Julian Bergini opens the Q&A by asking what that world would look like.
If technology is not the enemy, right? I mean, can we combine, is there a way of combining what you like about mixed agriculture with, you know, best up-to-date scientific knowledge to improve yields, improve things, etc.? Is there a good place for technology?
Absolutely. I think this is certainly not... certainly not an anti-technologist agenda. This is very much about using the very best of what technology today and in the future has and folding it with traditional wisdom. This is about moving away from, frankly, a stupid way of producing food, which is using chemicals and working against nature in a way which is undermining our very life support systems as a species, and embracing a much more common sense way of producing food.
Can I just, again, just one last one before we open up. The obvious thing people might say is the way it's presented would make it seem like, in a sense, this is a no-brainer, right? Mm-hmm. That the way we're doing it at the moment is we're taking the animals off the land, we're growing feed for them, and we're creating these horrible monocultures, which are wildlife deserts. And that's just really inefficient. And what's efficient is mixed farming, because there you've got the animals who are, you know, their own dung and everything is feeding the soil, it's rotating. The sort of obvious sort of dumb question is, you know, if the way you're advocating it is really the most efficient way, why aren't we doing it already? Given that farmers, even big food companies, people may hate big food companies and everything, but if their business is to make money, they're not going to be interested in less efficient ways of doing it, surely. So if it's not the most efficient way, what creates the illusion of efficiency?
Well, I think that what's happened is that the intensive industrial industry has hijacked the language and the paradigm. Let me give you an example. To my mind, the most efficient way of producing meat and milk is to have a cow on a grassy hillside. But in that space, you know, it's efficient because the animal isn't competing with humans for food. You know, it's essentially turning something which we can't eat into something we can, so grass into meat, milk and eggs, in a very efficient transition. But what that doesn't do is provide a market for the animal feed industry. Because the cow on the grassy hillside doesn't need a load of corn or soya. It doesn't produce a market for the chemical industry, because you don't need the chemical pesticides or the artificial fertilizers. It doesn't provide a market for the drug industry, the pharmaceutical industry, because the animal has a natural balance, doesn't get sick so much, so doesn't need to be fed antibiotics to ward off disease. Remember that half the world's antibiotics are fed to farm animals, most of them factory farmed. The way that economics is constructed is that we need a food production system that provides markets for the big industries, the feed, the chemical, the pharmaceutical industry. And in this way, we've taken our eye off the ball, which is about feeding people with decent food.
Okay, I think we have a microphone. Who would like to kick us off?
Hi there, thank you for that. That was a really fascinating talk. I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail on, you talked about cars and biofuel, and just to go into a little bit more detail about that. And
Yeah, so there is a real shift, a real impetus to use corn crops for biodiesel, bioethanol in the US in particular. This is seen as a green energy because it's renewable, whereas you know oil, of course, is a fossil fuel. You use it once and that's it. Whereas the simplistic understanding is you can grow corn, can't you, every year. The problem is that it's not a sustainable use of the land because the corn is grown industrially in ways which is not only hugely polluting to places like the Gulf of Mexico, but is also depleting the soils. Again, it's an unsustainable way of doing business. But what's really happening here, why are we now selling corn to cars, is that it's this... incessant search for new markets for the same same product. The corn industry, very powerful, of course, in the US and other places. There's only so much corn you can sell to people. You know, I can sell you a loaf of bread for your family, but if I can also sell you corn. Cereal, and for that I'm using cereals generically. If I can sell you cereals to your cattle, then I can sell you a lot more. And then once your cattle is satisfied, why don't I sell it to your cars? And so it is this kind of, you know, basic market economy. But it's a distorted market economy because huge subsidies, be it in the US or in the European Union, go into propping up essentially the agricultural industry and have driven the rise of what I call the corn culture. When you strip it all away and come back to cheap meat is something that we pay for three times. We pay for once at the checkout, we pay for it a second time through agricultural subsidies, which are huge. £3.6 billion worth of agricultural subsidy go to farmers in the UK alone every year. And the third is in the cleanup cost to our health and to the environment, which are considerable.
Lady next to you.
Hi. I find it really interesting that you use compassion as an argument, because I think most arguments against industrial farming are intellectual, you know, like if this happens then we won't have enough rainforest, we won't have enough all of that. But I find that if I get into an argument about this with somebody and I say that, you know, if I bring up animal rights and animal cruelty in an argument, people just, I mean, not everybody obviously, but a lot of people just don't feel that sense of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to ask you, you know, if you're talking to somebody and they say, like, I don't care about the cow, you know, what is your...
No, well, absolutely. Well, compassion is where it starts for our organisation, Compassion in World Farming. We're our farm animal welfare organisation, and generally many people do care about animal welfare. Polling across Europe shows that people believe, 80% of people, I think, across Europe believe that farm animals should be treated better. But if the animal welfare argument alone doesn't win, there are plenty of arguments, for example, how we're undermining not just the environment but also our future and the quality of our food, that also help to sell. And that was really what I wanted to bring out in Farmageddon and Dead Zone, was to show to people, you know, if you care about wildlife, you should care about factory farming. If you care about the health of the food you're giving to your families, then you should care about factory farming. If you care about can we feed future generations, then you should care about ending factory farming. So that's how, that's really what the book is doing. It's showing that all of these issues are absolutely interconnected, and our future depends on us finding a new era of compassion for farm animals, for wildlife, and for the planet.
Okay, thanks so much. Gentlemen there?
Even if we all went vegetarian, do you have an optimum population in mind?
Okay.
Interesting question. Yes, have a look at the Homo sapiens chapter. The book Dead Zone is organised. Each chapter is headed by an iconic species, really looks into the story behind an iconic species, be it the Sumatran elephant or the jaguar or the penguin. There is a chapter in there near the end, which is Homo sapiens, where I explore this. And the thing which I actually delve into is the fact that there are two population explosions going on. One is the human population explosion, and for every trying to visualize what does a billion people extra actually look like. Well, it looks like 100 cities the size of London extra, plus 30 the size of Los Angeles. But the other thing which is going on is that there is a second population explosion of livestock, because for every 1 billion extra people, they come with 10 billion extra farm animals produced every year. So it's rather like, you know, those 100 Londons and 30 LAs are rather like fried egg, if you like. You've got that yolk in the middle where the people are, and then you've got this much bigger area of white of farmland where the farm animals are. So it's an interesting question that you pose. Have a look in the Homo sapiens chapter and see if that gives you the answer that you're looking for.
So you both asked questions to Philip. Were you happy with the answer? What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, he's really knowledgeable. I mean, and he's sort of lived all of these things and actually seen all of the change, which I think is one of the important things. So I kind of felt like I could trust what he had to say about them.
I think what he said about 80% of the British population actually caring about animals was quite a positive, affirming statistic. But yeah, I think it's true that intellectual arguments are a lot more influential in this kind of debate. And
when you mean, when you say intellectual, you're talking about climate change and things like that. That's stuff that's not so much about the heart and soul.
Yeah, the cycle about, you know, the numbers involved in the amount of land and how that would contribute to the nitrogen cycle and that cycle contributing to, you know, increasing temperature.
Yeah. Like
I agree, it's really hard when you're arguing with someone. And you try and say, you know, but, you know, this isn't very nice to the animals or whatever. And so I think it's trying to find the arguments that are about economics or climate change and stuff like that that actually kind of get people worried rather than rely on their kind of heartstrings.
Nicola Day is the investment director of Rathbone Greenback Investments, which has sponsored the talk. As Philip comes off stage, she tells me why it's so important for the company to align themselves with Philip's campaign.
We're looking at a very proactive stance in terms of our investments. Certainly animal welfare is one of the areas we particularly look at with our ethical investments, but embracing full sustainability. And you can see certainly from Philip's talk that you can't look at one thing in isolation. And that's what we're doing with our companies. When we're looking at companies and the type of companies we want to invest in, we're challenging them on all fronts of how they operate, not just looking at one isolated area, because ultimately we feel that will bring tangible benefits, not just to the company itself, but bringing in all these externalities, that they're only bearing costs on the rest of society and communities if they're not embracing them.
Is there one particular line that Philip delivered here today, or that is in his book, that gets you personally?
Yes, I think his line, actually, where he said that you're paying for meat three times, I think that was particularly powerful, because it is bringing in all those areas that you're not only just paying for it at the checkout, but you have to look at the subsidies that you're also in effect indirectly paying for, and also the externalities, which is the huge area that you don't put a direct cost on, and I think society are not aware of all these costs that are building up and getting worse.
You can find more about Philip's book tour at philiplimbury.com and get involved with Compassion in World Farming at ciwf.org.uk. Join us next month when we'll be at the Good Farm Animal Welfare Awards in London to meet the farmers and producers who set a new standard in compassion in the food industry and who are doing their bit to stop the machine.